And continuing our newspaper coverage for this Tuesday, the 26th of May, 2026, on the Talking Information Center, it's time now to begin the reading of the Boston Globe. And with the Boston Globe, we say hello to Liza and Peter.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Talking Information Center as we read from the front page of today's Boston Globe. The headline, well, one of the headlines is Reseeding a Piece of New England's Past. I think this is great. I remember nothing but Dutch elms dying when I was growing up. On a warm spring morning last week, amid tall grass dotted with dandelions gone to seed, rows of gangly young trees with freshly unfurled leaves stretched as far as the eye could see. These are American elms, saplings of the magnificent trees that were once ubiquitous in New England, cathedrals of green that graced parks and streets until they were nearly wiped out by Dutch elm disease in the mid-20th century. The little elms in this Vermont tree nursery may herald the return of a signature feature of the New England landscape. They are part of an experiment, more than 15 years in the making, that will help identify elms that can fend off the disease. Scientists from the U.S. Forest Service and the Nature Conservancy are injecting each tree with spores of the deadly fungal pathogen that caused the blight. Seedlings from the trees that survive could be soon planted across the region, bringing a disease-resistant generation of American elms to life. "This is what it takes to save a species," said Gus Goodwin, the project leader for the Nature Conservancy in Vermont. "These trees may also eventually help New Englanders fight the effects of climate change. Scientists hope to reintroduce them to floodplains where large elms once dominated the canopy. As the warming climate brings more heavy rain to the regions, stands of elms could help soak up and spread floodwaters, keeping the neighborhoods safe and dry. Elms do all the good stuff the trees do best," said Cornelia Wilson, a research ecologist who leads the project for the Forest Service. "And if the experiment succeeds, towering elms could return to neighborhoods and downtowns from Connecticut to Maine." Goodwin imagines planting some of his in his own yard one day with his children, now 4 and 1. "I want them to see and understand that there are repairs we can offer to the natural world," he said. "Even in the face of overwhelming odds, there are still opportunities to nurture life. No tree has loomed larger in American history." Americans have long prized elms for their tall, stately canopies and verdant shade. They captured the imagination of poets, painters, and photographers. An elm in colonial Boston, known as the Liberty Tree, was the gathering place for the first large protest against British taxation in 1765. The Washington Elm in Cambridge is said to be where George Washington took command of the Continental Army, as legend has it, at least. No tree has loomed larger in American history than the American elm, and nowhere more so than in New England, wrote Thomas J. Campanella, a Cornell professor, in a book chronicling the history of elms in the region. By the 1920s, elms were planted across the country, but they remain the most concentrated in New England, where they form neat rows along elm streets or shaped parks and public squares. Frederick Law Olmsted, the famed landscape architect behind Boston's Emerald Necklace, used elm trees as prominent recurring features in his designs. The arrival of the Dutch elm disease, first detected in 1931, ravaged that legacy. Scientists believe the fungus that causes the disease was introduced through elm logs imported from Europe. The pathogen clogs the elm's vascular system, which is responsible for transporting water and nutrients, effectively choking the tree. The disease tore through the country. By the 1960s, most New England elms had succumbed to the fungus. By the 1980s, it had killed more than 70 million elms nationwide. Elms still grow today, but it's rare to find a large, old elm in the wild. It's a dramatic difference, Campanella said. It's very hard to compare anything but a clear-cut forest. Despite decades of research on Dutch elm disease, the options available to arborists are limited and expensive. In Boston, only 20 American elms remain on the Boston Common, Public Garden, and Commonwealth Avenue Mall. The Friends of the Public Garden are battling to keep the trees, along with about 380 other elms, alive and healthy. Every 3 years, they bore pen-sized holes in some elms and pump in fungicide, with a single treatment running as much as $3,000. Crews trim branches that show early signs of disease, marked by leaves that wilt and turn yellow. Sticky traps, scattered across the park, capture the beetles that are responsible for the fungus spread. It's a tough fungus, said Cody Jennings, senior parks care manager. The coastal town of Castine, Maine, is one of the few places in New England that still has a large number of mature American elms, many dating to the 1800s. Campanella posits that they may have been protected by favorable ocean winds in the area. Castine also took aggressive steps to combat the disease during the past century, and it currently treats about 75 trees with fungicide. Don Tenney, 79, remembers how it used to be during his childhood when he spent his summer in Castine and Main Street was lined with elms. They were gorgeous, said Tenney, now the town's tree warden. They were everywhere. As a college student at the University of Vermont, he recalled standing on campus and being unable to see Lake Champlain through the canopy of magnificent old elms that filled Burlington. Today, the view is clear to New York. A hopeful moment. Toward the southern end of Champlain, at the Elm Nursery in Benson, Alex Stephenson took a break from injecting the saplings with Dutch elm disease. His work for the Nature Conservancy is mostly spent on a computer, but he wanted a hand in the field research. That morning he learned how to inoculate a tree, drill a hole, inject a tiny amount of liquid containing thousands of fungus spores, mark the tree, repeat. It feels like a hopeful moment, he said. Previous research projects have yielded a handful of elm cultivars resistant to Dutch elm disease, but not all are suited for New England's growing conditions, nor do they offer enough genetic diversity to reforest the wild, experts said. The Vermont Project is one of four regional U.S. Forest Service studies underway to find resistant elms adapted to local conditions. The first step was finding survivor elms, mature trees with dead and dying elms nearby. Those had likely survived several bouts of the disease. Scientists have identified some traits that appear to confer resistance, such as a narrower water-carrying channel inside the tree, but they're still learning about others. The scientists gathered branches from 53 of those elms and used them to propagate new trees, some genetically identical, and others progeny from flowers on those same branches. There are about 5,300 saplings in the Benson Nursery, each with some built-in resistance to Dutch elm disease because of their youth, in addition to whatever benefits their genes might provide. But researchers have to defend them against other threats, such as hungry deer and voles that nibble at the base of trees. Once the injections are complete at Benson and a second smaller nursery in northern Vermont, scientists will monitor the trees for 2 years to determine their hardiness against the disease. They caution that even highly resistant elms can sometimes still be felled by the fungus. Wilson hopes about half of the survivor elms will have an adequate level of resistance that can be passed along to offspring. Clones of those successful original trees will be planted in an orchard producing seeds for the restoration project. If the tea uses the nursery in Benson as an interim seed orchard, Wilson said, the trees could produce resistant seeds within the next decade. That may sound like slow progress, but it's the nature of the work. We're lucky that elms will produce seeds as young as 15 years, Wilson said. That is still a really long time for humans. When Goodwin pictures the future of the project, he has grand ambitions. A seed orchard in every New England state, a resistant elm for every Elm Street, and the targeting of planting of those trees on floodplains. Since the scientists caution, they do not want to see a return to the unbroken elm canopies of yesteryear. Such close proximity contributed to the rapid spread of Dutch elm disease, and plantings dominated by a single species are more vulnerable to pests and diseases. In other words, the elm streets of the future will have a mix of trees, new elms among them. They will have their own beauty.
Yay!
Yay, I love that. I remember the Dutch elm disease going by in the early 50s.
I do, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everyone. This is Liza speaking, of course. I am going to read an article from the front page of today's Globe. Healy pitches abortion protections. Healy elevates reproductive access as economic issue. Oh, hold on. There we go. Governor Maury Healy's reelection pitch hinges on promises to corral Massachusetts' high cost of living, as she and other Democrats argue the party should shift its attention from the cultural wars of past election cycles and toward the pocketbook pressures buffeting their constituents. Still, Healy is holding tight onto one key societal debate. Abortion rights, she's argued, remain a clear motivation for residents heading to the polls. Healy has homed in on federal rulings that could upend access to abortion pills through the mail, holding press conferences at the State House and firing off public statements. She's laced her bid for a second term with the argument that she's best suited to protect the right in Massachusetts against two Republican opponents who each say they have no intention of changing the law here. In a Globe interview, the first-term Democrat said preserving access to abortion is not just a social issue, but also an economic one, a framing that appears intended to tap into residents' deep-seated concerns about being able to afford to live in a state that simultaneously emerged as a major national provider of abortion care. Excuse me. Make no mistake about it, abortion is economic, and the ability to access abortion care or not has real consequences for women across this country, she said. It has consequences in terms of their health. Sometimes consequences are life and death, and it does have economic consequences. Healy is facing pressure to find ways to help ease Massachusetts' high costs. Residents are leaving the state, some in search of lower-cost locales. Energy bills are reaching new highs. Home ownership is out of reach for many. And child care costs here are among the nation's highest. Lowering costs should be the focus of every elected official in America, Healy said during her State of the Commonwealth address in January. It's certainly mine. Scott Ferson, a Massachusetts-based Democratic political strategist, said Healy is most comfortable discussing protections for reproductive health care because of her background as a former attorney general who sued the Trump administration over access. There's enough crises here to occupy voters' time, Ferson said, of fears over both abortion access and the economy. And so she's right to talk about both. Healy has long argued for increased access to abortion. The state stockpiled 15,000 doses of mifepristone in 2023 amid an early legal challenge to the drug. And Healy issued an executive order in 2024 confirming access to emergency abortion care in the state. Last year, she signed a bill that bolstered protections for doctors providing reproductive health care from legal repercussions in other states. Jane Rayburn, a Massachusetts-based pollster who has worked with New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani and Maine U.S. Senate candidate Graham Planter, agreed that access to abortion has economic consequences as people consider whether they can afford to have a child. Restricting economic freedom, removing folks' autonomy from making these choices on how they build their family and their family's future, cuts right at the heart of the cost of living and affordability issues that we're all experiencing firsthand, Rayburn said. Healy has tried to bring her work on reproductive rights to sharper focus this year as two Republicans battled each other for their party's nomination. Brian Shortsleeve, who led the MBTA under former Governor Charlie Baker, said he supports the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to maintain, at least temporarily, access to mifepristone through the mail. He also said he supports abortion rights, including the state's current law as it is. I wouldn't change it, he said. Mike Minogue, who won the Mass GOP's gubernatorial endorsement last month, has described himself as a pro-life Catholic. He runs a nearly $23 million family foundation with his wife, Renee Minogue, that has donated to groups that have touted pro-life stances, including 8,000 between 2018 and 2024 to Prager University, a conservative media organization whose founder, Dennis Prager, has said most abortions are not moral. The foundation also gave $5,000 in 2015 to the Mass Family Institute, an anti-abortion pro-family advocacy group, and $55,000 between 23 and 24 to Taylor University, an Indiana-based Christian institution that promotes a sanctity of life statement. Minogue did not respond to questions about the donations, but said Healy and the liberal media will try to weaponize abortion politics. I cannot change the Massachusetts abortion law. Politicians approach this issue to drive hate and divisiveness, he said in a statement to the Globe. As a leader with faith, I have compassion and will support women with counseling, financial aid, and medical care. Healy cast both Republicans as threats to access here, arguing that neither will proactively stand up for reproductive rights. I'm going to be there to protect abortion access, and my opponents are not. And that's demonstrated by their actions, their words, and their records, she said. Healy's campaign has capitalized on the abortion-related court ruling and fundraising emails, casting a federal appeals court decision restricting medication abortion by mail as dangerous. The Supreme Court later issued a ruling preserving access to that drug. The Mass Democratic Party has also targeted Minogue directly, dubbing him anti-abortion Mike Minogue, because of his pro-life beliefs. Claire Tiluni, Interim Executive Director of Reproductive Equity Now, an abortion rights group, said voters have a lot on their minds this election cycle and accused the Trump administration of creating chaos and uncertainty on a range of issues, including reproductive rights. It may not be that abortion is the only issue shaping this race, she said, but we do really believe it will be a significant one. Voters, too, say that the Massachusetts economy is a top issue, and likely Democratic voters said cost of living should be Healy's top focus, according to an April Suffolk University Boston Globe poll. But they also have mounting concerns about the future of abortion access. A UMass Amherst WCVB survey from 2025 found a decrease in the number of people, from 70% in October 2024 to 62% in 2025, who believed abortion would remain safe, legal, and accessible in Massachusetts following the Supreme Court's decision to end the constitutional right to an abortion in 2022 by overturning the landmark Roe v. Wade ruling. Erin O'Brien, a political science professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston, said abortion, at the very least, is a good wedge issue for her Healy. But she said the gubernatorial race will largely focus on affordability. Having abortion there helps her for turnout, O'Brien said, and to prevent people from going to the GOP. And that's that article. Pete, over to you.
Okay, well, thank you. And this is from the World section of today's Globe. Pope Leo calls for a robust regulation of artificial intelligence. Pope Leo XIV on Monday set out a sweeping vision for corporate executives, politicians, and individuals who will shape and be shaped by the future of artificial intelligence, warning leaders to safeguard humanity from AI's most disruptive effects. Leo's declaration came in the form of a papal encyclical, an open letter to all people of goodwill that ran to roughly 42,300 words in its English version. It outlined his desire to protect human dignity and agency in an age in which technology threatens to replace humans in many professional and social roles. He presented it alongside Christopher Ola, a co-founder of Anthropic, a major AI developer, in a symbolic gesture of dialogue between the leaders of the spiritual and the technological worlds. While emphasizing that technology should not be considered in itself as a force antagonistic to humanity, he wrote that the pursuits of great profits cannot justify choices that systematically sacrifice jobs. Leo called for government regulations of the private companies that are driving the development of AI, protection and retraining for workers whose jobs are threatened, education to help students think critically about technology, action to protect children from the violent, hypersexualized, or fake information online that is now generated by AI, safeguards to ensure that humans, not AI, remain responsible for all decisions regarding the use of weapons. Above all, he emphasizes the importance of retaining a fundamental social role for all humans. A society that guarantees employment is only a small fraction of the population, despite having a high level of technical development, risks exposing many to forced inactivity, he wrote. This creates a paradox of material progress and anthropological regression that undermines the foundation of a just and stable social peace, he added. Leo, presenting the encyclical to a packed hall at the Vatican, said his views had been shaped by conversations with scientists, engineers, and political leaders. He singled out Ola, with whom he pledged to work to find a way for humanity in this time of artificial intelligence. What a great sign of hope it is that our differences, we can listen, that during our differences, we can listen to one another, Leo said. Ola, who's not Catholic, praised the Pope's initiative, acknowledging that companies, including his own, need moral guidance to avoid being swayed by a set of incentives and constraints that can sometimes conflict with doing the right thing. We need moral voices that the incentives cannot bend, Ola added. Today is just the beginning, the start of a long collaboration between those who are building this and those who can see what we, from the inside, cannot, Ola said. Both men spoke along with a panel of theologians and Vatican officials before an audience of cardinals, computer scientists, journalists, and diplomats, including Brian Birch, the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See. Pope Francis, Leo's immediate predecessor, had also warned about the dangers of AI and called for the ethical use of technology. Although Leo publicly presented his encyclical Monday, he formally signed it on May 15th, the 135th anniversary of the publication of Rerum Novarum, or Of New Things in English, a major encyclical written in 1891 by his namesake, Leo XIII. The Pope's encyclical was timed to prompt comparisons with that earlier document, which guided Catholic teaching on how to protect workers after the technological and industrial disruptions of the 19th century. In the new encyclical, titled Magnifica Humanitas, or Magnificent Humanity, Leo struck a similar tone, warning of the new threat to workers posed by AI. It'd be nice to have a little bit of
morality built
morality
in.
And
I totally
philosophy
agree.
Yep. Built into some of this.
Okie dokie. Okay, this next article is also from the front page. Boys seem to thrive in vo-tech ed, but adding schools faces hurdles. Some research suggests that career and technical schools keep boys on track to graduation, but seats are limited. Inside the Coventry classroom at Harvard H. Ellis Technical High School in eastern Connecticut, three dozen students are building cabinets and framing walls. Saws buzz, hammers clank, and sandpaper scratches. But Julian Lawrence, 16, doesn't mind the noise. A mediocre student in middle school, he's now earning straight A's. In middle school, I hated sitting at a desk every day, Lawrence said. This gets my mind moving more. Only two of the 36 students in the classroom are girls, a ratio that mirrors the Coventry workforce. While a couple of other trades taught at Ellis Tech skew female, hairdressing and healthcare technology in particular, its overall enrollment is 70% male. Statewide, more than 60% of the roughly 11,000 students attending tech high schools are boys. Boys seem to be getting a bigger boost from the schools, too. In one frequently cited study, boys accepted into Connecticut's technical school were found to have better attendance and test scores and higher graduation rates and earnings than peers who just missed the admissions cutoff. Girls who go into the schools did just fine, but were no better off than their rejected peers. Yet many boys who might thrive in a technical high school are missing out because of a system-wide shortage of seats. This year, only 44% of the 7,850 applicants to the state's 17 technical schools got in. That's led some educators and advocates to call for adding more vocational schools. Nationally, boys lag behind girls on multiple measures of educational achievement, from kindergarten readiness to college completion. If tech schools can help narrow the gap, advocates reason, why not build more of them? We could add 1,000 more, and it would be good for boys, not bad for girls, and give parents more choices, said Richard Reeves, president of the American Institute for Boys and Men, a nonprofit research and policy group. Rise Together, a fund established by Reeves, is one of the many donors to the Hechinger Report and Big Local News, which together produced this story. There were 407 vocational or career or technical schools in 2024-25 school year that, like Ellis High, enrolled significant numbers of students as their primary institution, according to a Big Local News Hechinger Report analysis of federal data. That was an increase from 254 a decade ago. Reed's proposal isn't cheap. He puts the cost of running the new schools at an estimated $4 billion annually, a figure he based on Connecticut's $5,000-per-student supplement for technical school students. And that doesn't include construction costs. Considering the financial challenges many districts are facing, skeptics question whether there are less expensive ways of expanding technical education to more boys. That might include renting space so existing programs can expand, are opening up vocational classrooms to students who attend traditional schools at night or on weekends. A prominent theory about why boys get a bigger boost from attending technical schools is that they simply have more room to grow than girls, who tend to do pretty well in traditional high schools, said Sean Doherty, a professor of education and policy at BC. Boys may also find the work-based learning that takes place at technical high schools to be more relevant and engaging than traditional classroom instruction. They see the purpose in what they're doing, said Michael Crocco, superintendent of the Connecticut Technical Education and Career System. They can take what they learn in the classroom and put it into practice immediately. But technical high schools are costly to build and maintain, requiring expensive equipment and low student-faculty ratios, said Alicia Hyslop, Chief Policy Research, the Content Officer at the Association for Career and Technical Education. Teacher shortages are another hurdle. In southern New England, where many vocational schools have long wait lists, the competition for seats has spurred heated arguments over how they should be allocated. Should they admit only the highest performing students or prioritize those less likely to be college bound? Recently, both Connecticut and Massachusetts switched